Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is musician and modern rock anti-hero Ben Folds. He's joined in conversation by Adine Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And now, join Bob Fields on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Ben Folds and Adine Vaziri.
Ben Folds is widely regarded as one of the major music influencers. Today, he's created a body of genre-bending music that includes pop albums with Ben Folds 5, solo albums, and collaborative records. In his new book, A Dream About Lightning Bugs, he reflects on his life so far, imparting hard-earned wisdom about art and life and ruminating on the challenges of sustaining a multi-decade, multifaceted career in music. Ben is joined on stage by Adine Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Adine has also written for many other publications, including Rolling Stone, National Geographic, MTV, Vibe, and Amazon. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Ben Folds and Adine Vaziri.
Thank you for spending your birthday with us. Do you usually celebrate by doing a book tour? Is that?
I'm usually working on my birthday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And please do not sing. Yeah. We established that up front.
Mr. Folds has requested that you don't sing the happy birthday song to him on this tour.
What I loved about this book is that you can jump in at any point and you're going to read a really great story, even though, you know, it works chronologically as well. How did you remember this stuff? I think you have... Let's talk about the title of the book. It starts when you're two? One?
Yeah.
Younger? Yeah. How did...
Well, you know, the first chapter in terms of, like, form, because as a songwriter, I'm always concerned with form. You have to be concerned with form when you write a song, because if you're not, you find yourself in a 4-minute art form where you either haven't said anything you want to say or you got it all out of the way too early. The pacing of 4 minutes is really important. So I was looking at the book and thinking about how I would put this together. And I realized I needed to mention up front that I listened to 8 hours of music a day when I was 2 years old. And the two things that strike me as significant about that is, one, this it's extremely obsessive and it's weird. And it got me a free trip to the child psychologist when I was a kid. The other thing is that, you know, I've been increasingly interested in music therapy. And obviously, music in the brain is part of it, and music education. And my music neurology friends tell me that that's significant. That 8 hours of music a day when you're 2 years old is, while it's obsessive and probably keeping me from doing other things, it's given me a lot of associative real estate in my brain to remember things from that particular era. So if you're listening to a lot of music when you're 2 years old, you have a lot of brain to hijack to remember a lot of stuff, right? So I mentioned that up front, and I tried to mention it in a way that didn't seem like a thesis for the book, right? Because I didn't want to say, like, you know, this is a book about remembering. But I didn't want it to be suspect. I remember all this very, very specific stuff from my life that I really think that I hang on the framework of music. The fact that music was there to, and with music therapy, when they're dealing with patients with dementia, playing music from when they're young brings back everything, and everyone knows that. So yeah, 8 hours of music when I was 2 years old. We lived in 14 houses before I was out of high school, and I could draw you the floor plans of all of them. And that's because I remember where I was sitting when I was listening to Otis Redding, or I remember where I was sitting when I was listening to Elton John, or any of the different years that come up, and I can remember the year, the position on Casey Kasem's top 40 charts. And so that's why I put that at the beginning, and the rest of it are memories hung on music and what music did to inform those years for me.
Why did you feel like this was the time to stop and reflect and write a book? Because obviously you're in the middle of your career, still figuring things out after all this time, still moving in new directions, but why did it feel like the right time to hit pause and reflect?
I mean, I don't know. I was talking to I was writing my will, and maybe it's time for me to write my story too. I you know, there's things like when you write a book like that. I mean, I think it's a combination of the reality of a career is that things, you know, you get opportunities at certain times. And the opportunity arose to write a book. And of course, the one that would be the most logical is my story, you know, because one, I don't have to make anything up. And secondly, you know, there would be people that would be interested in that. That's a genre. But I think for me, besides the fact that just came up and a book agent came to me and asked me if I would do that, I really felt like I had a lot of things to say about creativity. And that is really underneath the whole book is, you know, leaving my story behind and, you know, my belongings behind my will is one thing, but like a story about creativity in an era where we've become, so sort of expert oriented. And everyone's got their expertise, and that's good because that makes civilization work. But then over on the side, we've got the little creative people. And the little creative people over here are making their little arts and crafts and things. And it gets marginalized. You don't realize that it requires creativity to do everything that put human beings at the top of the food chain. Like, if we were in the middle of the food chain, it's certainly... It doesn't take an anthropologist to figure out that what put us at the top was creativity and ideas. So creativity runs through everything. And the celebration of that is so marginalized. It's like you know, these little panels that I go on all the time where everyone's going, arts, 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 arts. And it's like, yes, creativity across humankind is going to get us out of all of our jams. And to me, celebrating creativity for me needed to be in a very first-person way. So I could write a book that said creativity is important for these reasons. But instead, I thought I would say, you know what? I grew up, everyone's different. And my way of different was not that special because we're all different and we're all unique. My way of being different was that I played music on a turntable, a little turntable with a doggy had like a doggy theme thing, and it had like a bone for a tone arm. And I was sitting on the floor playing records for 8 hours, and that's weird. But everyone's got something that's odd, right? And, you know, as I went through my life, whatever the sequence of events was, you know, it's like, so I'm listening to 8 hours of music a day. Well, my parents didn't care. They were fine with that. My grandmother said, you know, he should go to a child psychologist, which I did, but my mother, who's the one that took me to child psychologist, reported back to my grandmother that I was completely normal and I was ahead for my age. It's not what the doctor said. In fact, the amazing thing about my mother is that, and I just talked to her about 2 hours ago, is that she, to this date, would not tell me what the doctor actually said. And she was 19 when she had me. And she grew up in a pretty low bottom of the rung orphanage, children's home. And her mother just sent her there. And her mother was sent there, one of five children. The other four got to stay home. How odd is that? Like, she would escape from, my grandmother would escape from the children's home and find her way back home, and they'd all be eating dinner. And they'd say, "You're not welcome here. You go back to the children's home." This is such a weird cycle. My mother cut that off completely. And my father, his father, kept him up at knife point. Like, sitting there with a knife, crying at the edge of his bed, saying that he was going to kill the family and take them to Jesus and they'd all be together. And my father never passed any of that on to me. My mother never passed anything. She didn't send me to an orphanage or anything. And I think that's absolutely amazing, because people talk about cycles and how you can't break them. Along with breaking the cycle, they didn't seem to carry any knowledge about how a family is formed or raised, or what you should do with a kid. And a lot of people were like that. Like, you know, your parents just didn't know. It's like, I don't know. Like, everyone's a f-ing expert these days. But like, back then, no one knew. And as a result, I enjoyed an improvisational upbringing. Like, my brother did not enjoy the improvisational upbringing. But I loved it. It was perfect for me. And so as I'm painting a picture of creativity, I can only speak for myself. You know, the things that I did that were creative were assets in my life, and my parents treated them as such. No matter what they got wrong, and they got a lot of stuff wrong, because all parents do. You know, I'm a parent. I'm finding out what I did wrong every day. Anyway, that was underneath the book, and that's I'm right. Pontificating.
And there's no revisionist history in here, because you play up all those awkward moments. I mean, you don't play them up. You just recount all the awkward moments, all the embarrassing, you know, what would be considered embarrassing moments.
They're embarrassing.
And I thought the whole point of writing a rock biography is to make yourself sound cool, but you totally went against that. This is not "No One Here Gets Out Alive."
Sure didn't do that, did I?
No.
Thank you.
What was the thinking there? Did you want to embrace? I mean, you wanted to share these moments, obviously, with the people who are reading it. What was going through your head when you wrote this?
Well, I mean, you're probably younger than me. I don't know. I mean, we're rough contemporaries. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But the point is we both. We won't go into that. But you write about music. And so you may actually be more aware than I am of certain things. I would be happy to be corrected. But when I was growing up, and maybe when you were growing up, the rock stars, especially since they wrote their own material, wrote on brand, you know, and they wrote to support their greatness. And it makes sense. That's the total human incentive behind that. You know, like the rock stars of the 70s, which I grew up with, Their even their admissions, if they said they were weak, they still are getting out in front of the story, you know, like, or someone did them wrong and they were the right. They knew everything. And that was what was appealing about the rock star when I was growing up, is that they were in control. They knew everything. And I think that just every generation likes to just be contrarian. So my generation's contrarian attitude towards that was, what if we don't know everything? What if we are dorks and we're awkward all the time? And I suppose I was at the problem, I think, close to the front of the wave of that. There are examples of, I mean, I think Randy Newman, 10 years ahead of his time, was always wrong, you know, and he was willing to write characters and sing those characters that were weak. Aside from that, you know, there's one song by Loudon Wainwright called "Red Guitar," and it's, he's just smashed his guitar at home alone, and he's put it in the fireplace, and it's burning. And his wife Kate comes in and says, "Why have you done this?" He's like, I don't know. Why did it? But if you think about that song, it's a total outlier in that area, because everyone else was trying to be cool. And so, when I was writing a book about art, songwriting, creativity, my life, if I didn't lower my guard and go ahead and tell things that were uncomfortable for me, I would have no credibility trying to tell a kid you should write an honest song which shows vulnerability, but you look at the book. And vulnerability is like interesting because it's not just saying, yes, I was weak. It's about being willing to, with no defense at all, paint a character that is obviously flawed and weak. And if you're willing to do that, like, you know, my feeling when I first started writing songs was, okay, so the songwriters that come before would say stuff like, you know, like it's in the book, like, girl, I cried for you. It's like, well, first of all, I don't believe you. And who talks like that? Why not you sat across the table from your girlfriend who actually you didn't know for long enough to be even having this conversation with, and you're staring at your fries and they're getting cold and you don't feel anything. Like the fries, your cold fries guy, and you don't feel anything, that the girl in front of you is crying her eyes out and you don't feel a thing. That to me is weakness. And if you're willing to put that in a song, then other people who are also either victims of the weak bastard who wrote the song or also feel that too, maybe they would understand that. And that was the premise of the way I wrote songs. I didn't know that at the time. At the time, I was like trying to write things that I felt like were breaking the law. And breaking the law to me was writing something that was not cool. Yeah.
Well, my favorite image in that book is you, when you're starting to write songs, you're out on your front yard in your boxers eating a bowl of cold cereal.
When you say image, there's a picture.
Well, I was going to say, so you read that, and then you turn the page, and there's the actual picture of you out on the lawn with your boxers on and the bowl of cereal. And you're in your 20s
like
at the time. You're not
19 years old.
It's not like you're 14 or 12. But
Yeah. I'm a grown-ass man.
Thank you for sharing that image with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the secret? Like, what was that sparked the songs? That because you wrote a lot of good songs in those moments. That
I think what I was trying to show in that probably was one, the value of writing away from your instrument, because that is using the highest. I didn't put this in the book, but I you know, if I was going to write more kind of creative self-helpy, and maybe I would write a book that was about creative resolution. The brain is the highest creative resolution we know. It has all the gray, the gray area between. We live in a real increasingly menu-driven resolution. So if you have five choices, your resolution is like this five-tier thing, but then there's all this space between all of it that you can imagine. But why imagine? You've already got five things on the menu. But the truth is that that's not like a new evil thing. The piano itself is lower resolution creativity than your brain, because when you sit down, you're docking your hands and they look like, I mean, unless someone's hands are have been altered or are different, we all generally are supposed to have five fingers on each hand and they're roughly the same proportion. So when you put it down to a piano that's always the same sounds are going to come out. You're going to land in the same place. Your hands are going to fall in a certain place. If you imagine what you want the piano to sound like, and then the hands have to keep up, then you're working at a higher creative resolution. And so what I think I was trying to show by walking around, besides I'm aware of, you know, I like an entertaining story, and so I like an entertaining picture of me and my boxers out in front. That was like a highway in front of my house. People would just drive by, and I wasn't aware because I had my bowl of cereal, which I had at like, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was still pacing at 1 o'clock with the old cereal bowl up and down, but I was running the songs through my head over and over again. A lot of music engineers will tell you the secret to making a good mix is to sit on your hands. Sit on your hands and listen. Don't jump right into it. Old school composers would want to compose in their head, and I came across that by accident. I came across that by accident because We didn't have a piano in the house when I would love to have when I was younger. And we didn't have anything to record anything on, which I would have loved to. And I didn't know about the iPhone yet, but damn, that would have been cool. Anything that you could have used to be a tool would have been cool. But the only tool I had until I was about 10 years old was my mind. And I was wandering around construction sites waiting on my father, who was a carpenter, to be finished with his work. And so I would imagine music. And when I think about like kids coming up now, and I know that creativity wins out, and I believe that. But I also think that kids coming up now have the incredible hurdle of getting past the menu. Getting past the menu, turning the thing off, not because it's evil, it's a wonderful device, but the creative resolution of the mind is all those shades of gray between. Put the damn thing down, put the piano down, even the guitar, and pace up and down the street in your boxers or naked or whatever it is you have to do, and think about what you want to hear, what music is playing in your mind, the things that you've synthesized from the day. It's just the highest resolution. And that would be my next book if I was going to write a, you know, a fancy book.
You're listening to musician and modern rock anti-hero Ben Folds, whose new book is A Dream About Lightning Bugs. He's joined in conversation by Ideen Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And, you know, your life really is setback after setback, and at some point you're just like, is this guy ever going to be, you know, we know how it ends, but is this, as you're reading it, you're like, is this guy ever going to be okay? Are things ever going to go right for him? What did you think of the character after you had written it and went back and read it? Like, what did you think of this? I know it's you, but
yeah.
When you read a book, you can't help but cast judgment on the person you've read about.
Totally.
How did you feel sorry for this person? Did you feel... Yeah.
No, that's an interesting question, because you do separate yourself not only from the character that was your youth, but also the character that could have been, you know, which I was waiting tables and had a bunch of songs in my back pocket, which are the ones that people in this room have probably heard. I was waiting tables. Can I help you, sir? Can I help you, ma'am? These songs in my back pocket. And they weren't bad songs because I was still waiting tables. So I wrote this for me as that person as well. And I look back on all the different characters that are in the book that could have been, all the sliding doors and stuff. The one that's in the book that is the best I can remember about the events of me, you know, the way I like to think about it is that I put hardship in the book for, I guess, a couple reasons. One is because I talk to kids all the time who are trying to bust into the music business, right? And they're up against all this stuff. There's no reason for me to sugarcoat that and make it glamorous, because it's not. You know, a decision not to be an artist, a decision not to be a musician for a living, is a very reasonable decision. And someone who has made that decision should not feel ashamed for having made a reasonable decision for the short life they have and the other people who depend upon them. I think that if you're going to jump into it, you ought to know that it is constant demoralizing failure. It is constant. And you have to know that if you're going to jump into it. If you know that, then you can be amazed at the moments that you have when your music is working. If you're playing for six people in a little club and three of them are talking, and three of them are listening, and then you blow out the PA system that you rented for $100, and you have to take that back at 6 in the morning, drop it off with a note and a check, and then go back to work waiting tables, that's your day. And you're an artist, and that's your day. And if you don't understand that, and you think it's something else, and we paint this picture that it's something else, in painting the picture that it's something else, we're doing people a great disservice, because someone who is, I put it at the end of the book, Charles Ives, who was one of our most innovative American composers in the turn of the 20th century, he was an insurance guy. His day job was selling insurance. And I think that that's honorable. He's selling insurance to do that. There's 50 years in human history where a rock star would be celebrated and become a millionaire. Before that, all the years all the way back, there's no evidence of that at all. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that in the future. So if you're going to jump in, you're going to be an artist, you're doing it because of those moments that you're expressing, the thing that you saw, the joy of that overrides all the demoralizing failure you had. And if someone's watching television and think that looks like a lot of fun, it's not fun or fun. It's just they're just living, and they're probably nervous. They probably stink. And there's probably other stories behind it, and their ego is massive and all that kind of stuff. But I just meet so many kids who are like, how can I make it in the music business? And I think that's part of the reason why I wrote this.
And I think the most on-brand story in there is that you didn't want Brick to come out as a single. It was your one breakthrough moment. You were fighting against it. Do you feel like that song gave away too much about you? Do you cringe when you hear it?
I don't cringe when I hear it. I just had an understandable freak out because I wrote it in the place that you should write a song from, a vacuum. It's hard to write a song from a vacuum. It's hard to write a song and not consider how someone will hear it, not consider how it might change your life. Then once you've made one or two albums, then the songs that you write, they might change your life. And it's interesting. You write about music. You write about music and people read it. And when they read it, it goes into their head. And then they're making another album. Now their job is to get that the f*** out of their head, but also to use what it is that was the feedback loop and the necessary part of having someone having given them some feedback. It's very complicated. But at that moment when you make something, it has to be expressive. That's all. But you hone your skill at a moment where you are aware. And if you don't have feedback, intelligent feedback, heartfelt emotional feedback, you can't get there. But at that very moment when you're making things, you have to have the skill to block that out. Because at that moment, all that matters is the thing that you're feeling. And it's really hard to do. A song like Brick, I wrote it in the vacuum. But then the vacuum was over, and it's like I sent it to Sony. It's like, what have I done? Because I haven't consulted. This is a story of teenage abortion. I'm one of the stars of the song. My girlfriend from high school is the main star of the song, and she didn't write it, and she didn't have a voice in that. And all of a sudden, it's coming out. And so, of course, I'm like, the first thing I do is call a label and say, I know you're really high on the song, but I don't think it's that good. It's like, we kind of rock. It's not that good. Maybe it's a B-side. Try to talk them out of it a little bit. And then I realize they're gung-ho on this being the single. So then, of course, I take a deep breath and I call my girlfriend from high school I haven't talked to for a long time, who actually lived out here in San Francisco for a while. But that's tough when you've written some, but you have to keep them compartmentalized. And when they come out, you've got to be lab coat technician. You've got to be the guy that replaced the heart valves and stuff. And then you meet the guy for dinner, and it doesn't occur to you that the guy that's sitting across from you is eating a steak. you gave him his heart valves. You have to detach yourself. I sing these songs. They don't mean anything to me at all. But I know they mean something to other people, and I remember when they meant something to me. And so you kind of keep it compartmentalized.
Did it change the way you wrote songs afterward? Were you more careful or considerate about what you were giving away?
No. I wasn't, but I had my moments between. But then when it knocks on the door and you realize, I'm a real mercenary about writing songs. My job is to write the best song. And if writing the best song, which it often is to pilfer from your own life and from the lives of those around you, you got to do what you got to do. Randy Newman said, and bring him up again because he's one of my favorites, said he would run over his grandmother for a song. I too would run over Randy Newman's grandmother for a song. You'll do what you got to do, because if you're a craftsman And I think that's the thing that is often lost, and it should be lost. Like, you shouldn't have to think about it unless you come to a plumber's convention where we're talking about sprockets and the insides of it and stuff. But mostly, an audience should be completely unaware of the seams of a song, the effort, and whether or not you care, whether it's true, you should feel it. And, you know, so a song that you had to take something out of your own life and that made life tough on you, I don't think people have to be burdened with that. I mean, sometimes I'll have like, you know, and I did up to 28 years old, I was doing service work, right? So I don't mean this is a slight on people in any kind of service industry, because I have a lot of respect. But when I was waiting tables, for instance, I didn't tell people what was required to get their food to the table. But a lot of people sometimes feel like they need to tell you everything that it took to get there. You know, it's like, all right, Mr. Foltz, we got this air conditioner working because we did this and this and this. And it's like, I kind of like don't walk on stage and say, all right, people, I had to put these chords together. I had a harmonic structure that was very difficult there and to do this. And I think when it comes to songs, the best thing to do is to use what you can, put a barrier between you and the song, and let people just enjoy it. I think it's the best way to go. But looking back, I did hit on my life a lot. I upset some people along the ways, and I've made myself very vulnerable to criticism. And I just have to put that away, because I have to go, I wrote a song. Made people happy or made people sad. That's my job. And of course, we're like in a bubble now where we're talking about it. But mostly, I think that's not honorable.
This book also doubles as your work, it backs up your work as an advocate for music education. You have a chapter where you thank all the teachers who helped you along the way, even though you were pretty much had a terrible school experience all along. Tell me a little bit about what your advocacy work and what you've been doing, what your day job is now.
We try to spend, I say we because my partner is my manager, and my manager does not come from music. He comes from politics. He was Al Gore's press secretary for 15 years, and he got out of the politics business for the most part. And the reason it was attractive to work with him was because, one, is say what you want about politicians, but a good part of their job is really to advocate for someone else. You know, that's the idea, is to do that. And I'm not such a cynic that I don't recognize that. And he and I get together and we go, okay, well, we can advocate for arts education, music therapy, arts policy, and the symphony orchestra for about a third of my time before we start to really lose money doing it, like when it becomes a problem and we need to pay bills and stuff like that. So we set aside a third of the time. And on a third of that time, I spend my time at the Kennedy Center as the artistic advisor to the National Symphony Orchestra. I'm very proud of that. It's not a terribly lucrative thing, but it's really important to me. You know, like I get more frustration and joy out of doing it. You know, like I could go on, I could spend 3 hours talking to you about that. I wouldn't shut up and you guys would be like, okay, we're going to go. Because it's real important to me, like what the symphony orchestra looks like and does in the future. And the fact that I have the National Symphony Orchestra as my guinea pigs and as my partners in trying things I think should happen. Because, you know, honestly, you know, San Francisco's orchestra is running circles around us, you know? And I'm not terribly competitive, and I love MTT. He's been a really great, he has been a really great mentor for me, actually. I mean, the guy has been so generous with me on emails. Like, I almost wrote the book and called it, you know, Emails with Michael. Because... what a champ. What a beautiful guy he is. But, you know, San Francisco and a lot of symphony orchestras in the country have these great ideas, and they kind of stay local. And I feel like, okay, well, we need to take these, do them better at the National Symphony Orchestra, and let that spread across the country as one thing. That's super important to me. And education. The reason I put the teachers in there is like, you know, I did a day of substitute teaching for 7th and 8th graders 2 days as a you know, music teaching music. It was brutal. They were animals. And I was, as a kid, worse than any of those kids. So I wasn't even getting my payback for what I was trying to deal with. But I kind of walked in thinking, you know, I'm used to show business. I can talk to people. I can just say, enough. It doesn't work like that. And the thing is there's always one kid who might need a little extra attention. And there's always a couple of kids who have it. And you have to, you know, read the room and take on each kid as one at a time. At the salary that teachers are paid, it's disgusting. It's disgusting. And
it's wonderful that you do that, because I think it's not an exaggeration to say music saved your life. I mean, not in that it kept you alive, but it put you on a path. And
absolutely.
Definitely get a sense from reading it. I'm going to move on to some reader. I'm sorry. You can tell I work at a newspaper. This is a good one. What advice would you, and I didn't, this isn't my question, by the way. What advice would you give an over-the-hill, out-of-practice pianist?
So you played when you were younger? Yes. And you haven't played in a long time? How long did you study piano for?
12 years.
And you study with a teacher?
Yeah.
Man, I would go back to any advice, seriously take with a grain of salt from anybody. My personal opinion is I think maybe find a good classically oriented teacher and go back to the basics and relearn, reacquaint yourself with the meditative beauty of playing scales and just like vegging out and playing scales and arpeggios. Find one or two simple pieces you want to play and, you know, just really typical stuff. But I think that the way of learning has changed a lot. I'm kind of an old stickler about, I think there's hundreds of years of wisdom behind learning something sort of classical. Maybe as a bit of fun, reacquaint yourself with theory. You know, like take an online theory course or something, or take an in-person theory course. Maybe even get a mentor that you're just going to meet for lunch and talk about key centers and music and listening list. Those are the things that occur to me.
These all ask, have you ever considered writing a musical?
Right.
And these are the rest.
Yeah. I have for a long time. I was approached first by the first big sort of Broadway production company in probably like 1999. Actually, the first person ever said anything to me about it was Pete Townsend. And yeah, it was badass. I was nervous, and I was playing on the Jules Holland show probably about 1997, 6. And I finished the song, and I saw Pete Townsend making a beeline to me through the middle. It was kind of this big BBC studio, and I thought he couldn't be coming to me. And I was like, "What's going on?" And he's like, "That was brilliant. Have you written a musical?" And I was like, "No." And he said, "Do it before you get old." That was it. And then he said, "No." He also said,
"I thought you're supposed to die before you get old."
Yeah, that's what. That's right. That's what he said. He's got that. Do it before you get
or
old.
Or write a musical, whatever.
Yeah. Insert, you know. Learn how to rebuild your carburetor before you get old. No, but he said, go see Rent. That's right. He sent me to go see Rent, which was still off Broadway at the time when he said that. And now I'm old and I haven't written a musical. So I don't really know. I mean, I like the idea of writing a musical. I also wonder, and this is me thinking too much, I also wonder if because my songs sound like they should be in a musical, that doesn't mean they should be. I mean, it's like they're very specific. And what I've noticed and I appreciate about musical music is that it pushes a narrative. I'm not sure that that's my skill. I mean, I think I could do it, but you know, things come along, like writing a book or writing a piano concerto, and those things, I have to tell you, are not as lucrative as writing a musical, but they're the things that are occurring to me right now. One day when I grow up, yes, I'll write a musical. Yeah.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is musician and modern rock anti-hero Ben Folds, whose new book is A Dream About Lightning Bugs. He's joined in conversation by Aydin Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
And I know we want to get you over to that piano, so I'll let you take the final question and
see
how seriously
bitch.
They take you as an author.
I know. Ben, rock this bitch. Should I? That's it?
Please okay. Do. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Very thoughtful. The thing about this rock this bitch thing is it was something that happened by accident, where some guy at a show yelled, in 2002, it was in Chicago, and we're making a live piano solo record, and he's like, rock this bitch. And so if anyone's heard that live album, what I did was just, I said, sorry, I don't know that song, and I made up one called that. And then since then, pretty much every night of my performance career, someone yells that. And the idea is I'm supposed to write something that is particularly unique to that night, that is different from all the rest I've done, that's made up on the spot, not prepared. And that's a lot of pressure. So you just do it as long as you can before something comes up. I remember an SNL skit about a songwriter. He was writing songs from scratch. And he drew a blank. He was cooking dinner, and the joke was that he said his song was called Chopping Broccoli. Chopping Broccoli. And so tonight I am here and I'm chopping bra, 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 what's up, bra, Colleen. To be in a hurry, you can let the notes speak and let them hang in the air, in the air, like a testicle. And so we're rocking this bitch in San Francisco, we're rocking this bitch at a very short piano. I don't judge pianos by their length. This is the key of G. Why is it the key of G? Is it because it has an F sharp? Or because the floor is G? Let that hang in the air like a test of music theory. Rocking this bitch in San Francisco. Rocking this bitch in San Francisco. Rocking this bitch while we're talking about my book.
I have no plan. And I was doing a paper airplanes tour, which you might know about. People threw airplanes on the stage. And the reason I did that is because I thought it's kind of brutal to have everyone screaming over each other to request a song. But I'm backtracking on that because I don't have a just... Thank you. You got it. All right. That's what I was hoping for. Songs in the key of F. It was written at the very end of the Whatever and Ever Amen record. My girlfriend, who became my wife for 6 months, who was from Marin County, actually, and is still a very dear friend of mine, whose name is Kate. She said, I hate that I've got the name Kate because it just does not musically pretty. You could never write a song with the name Kate. And so, no, I can write you a song with the name Kate. We just have to celebrate its percussiveness instead. So this is, you know, this is things I thought about Kate for a while. I thought because we got together, you know, I had this huge crush on her because she's just such a badass. And I just listed all the things that she was, that were badass about her. And I realized that some of them weren't badass at all. I just saw them as that. So I thought it would be fun to put them all in a song. So here's how the song goes. And I was a big fan, at the time of, and still am, of the Carpenters. So Karen Carpenter was my hero while making... I used to sit around listening to Karen Carpenter's drum solos. She was a drummer. And if you're so deep into the Karen Carpenter... wormhole that you've listened to all her drum solos, you're a true fan. And so this is also has Karen Carpenter in it. So. She plays Wipeout on the drums. The squirrels and the birds come, sat around and sing the guitars. Oh, I have you got nothing to say. Fail, she speaks. Her mixtape's a masterpiece. Walks through the garden so the roses can see. Oh, I have you got nothing to say. And you can see the daisies in her footsteps. Dandelions, butterflies. I wanna be Kate. Kate. Same thing. I think she smokes pot. She's everything I want. She's everything I'm not. No, I have you got nothing to say. She never gets wet. She smiles and it's a rainbow. And she speaks and she breathes. I wanna be Kate. I see her out every couple days. I want so that I can say, hey.
Sounds like a town hall meeting.
I wanted to play something that's really, I'll finish off with a song that is, it's another breakup song. It's relatively relatively new simply because I started to, I imagine a part of a breakup that, because breakup songs are good if they're really specific. If they're specific, for those of you who are going to make a career of writing breakup songs, the more specific, the better. And the more they imply the end, yet the beginning of something else, the better off you be, because no one just wants to hear the end. but this one was, I was thinking about breakups that the first night that the two separate people now from the couple are living in their own apartments for the first time. Probably some broke-ass apartment because you could afford something nicer together. So now you're sitting by yourself in your new life in your broke-ass apartment. And the first thought might be, I can put my stuff anywhere I want to now. And it's awesome because you can. Of course, you go back to sad again in a second. But the idea of kind of growing those emotional limbs back and going, what is it that I like to do first thing in the morning? Where do I want to put my stuff? Who the hell am I? Was what I was trying to get across in the song. The melody had sat with me for years. And I finally figured out that the song was called So There. And so here's the song. A mattress and a stereo, just like I started. And a note composed with thumbs and phone on unpacked boxes. It's so well written, but I won't be sending it. I will not forget you. There was nothing to forget. Oh, so there. Through shiny streets and dirty snow, blue skies in Ditmouth. Oh, Brooklyn is my second sleep. Yeah, I damn well did this. The world got big again, and you couldn't get rid of it. but I cannot forget you. There was nothing to forget. Oh, so thanks, y'all. Thanks, y'all, for showing up. Thanks for everything everyone did for me tonight. And thanks for buying my book.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was musician and modern rock anti-hero Ben Folds, whose new book is A Dream About Lightning Bugs. He was joined in conversation by Aydin Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.